Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann. This episode continues the PDC material by looking at water, including its importance, scarcity, and how we can use it to serve it. Due to the audio nature of this show, and to allow you to find out more about the topics that interest you, there are going to be more links than usual in the show notes. Stop by thepermaculturepodcast.com for a full list of the links. Of course, before we get to the body of the show, there are a few things to cover. First, I have a question for all of you. For those who are listening to the show that have already attended a permaculture design course, could you please let me know how many people were in your class? Or if you signed up for a PDC but it was canceled because of a lack of attendance, please let me know that as well. As I look into putting together another show on permaculture training opportunities, and having had a class canceled on me because not enough people signed up, I've been wondering what others' experiences have been like. Second, if you find the show valuable and useful in expanding your knowledge of permaculture, help other people find the show by emailing a link to your friends and leaving a review on your favorite podcast site. It'll really help. I was also reminded recently of the amount of information that gets dumped onto you in a PDC. Each one of these PDC shows represents the equivalent of about an hour to an hour and a half of class time lecture. Since we don't have the back and forth conversation and in-class exercises we would have in an in-person class, of course they're a little bit shorter. But when you take a PDC, you get 8+ hours of this kind of material a day when you're working in the classroom in preparation for the design practicum. In a very short period of time, you have a very broad amount of material with only so much depth. Then, once you're done and have completed the course, you can go out and dig the depths that go with it, find your interests, and build your body of knowledge. So I want to get this rapid-fire coursework and brain dump together so you can have it at your disposal. As time and questions arise, I'll revisit portions of the shows to flesh them out. Expect this and the rest of the PDC shows to be intense on the quantity of the content. Oh, and a disclaimer before we get into it. As we're dealing with water, please do your homework before implementing any of these solutions, especially if you're going to drink the water that you harvest, store, and treat. There are a lot of nasties out there, and this isn't really a scholarly work on every minute issue you could encounter. Drinking contaminated water over a long period of time can cause serious health issues, but in the short term, it could make you sick if you're lucky, or a lot worse if you're not. Millions die each year as a result of contaminated water. Don't be one of them. Be safe, do your work, and if you have any concerns, get the resulting water tested, and if you have questions, consult with an expert. There are lots of folks out there who make their living dealing with nothing but water issues, so don't be afraid to contact them. So then, water. This simple chemical is responsible for life on this planet that we call home. It covers 70% of the Earth's surface and makes up around 60% of the human body, depending on how old you are. Without it, many of our biological processes, such as the conversion of food into fuel, would cease. It is essential to life, and historically, it's also been important for civilizations. Wherever good water could be found, so too was humanity, settling down along the springs, rivers, and coastlines. There we could take advantage of the resources available. As seafaring peoples, we traveled the world to explore and trade goods. Within many religions, it is also used for ablution or ritual cleansing. We use it for agriculture, to irrigate crops, and for livestock. In the home, we wash with it, drink with it, and use it to prepare food. We swim in it, fight fires with it, and produce electricity via hydroelectric dams and also in our steam turbines. We use it to manage our bodily wastes via the toilet and our sewer systems. We depend on it falling from the sky to form snowpack in the mountains, which will then melt in spring and summer to feed our waterways. We build dams as reservoirs for our drinking water. And we also use it in science, many of our solutions for experiments, and it's also the basis for the gram. Just through these quick examples, I hope you can see how pervasive our relationship with water is. It's a part of us and our existence day in and day out. Without it to slake our thirst, we die, usually in about 3 days or so. Without clean, potable water, it's difficult to maintain good health and grow the food necessary for our very existence. And though it appears to be an abundant, infinite supply, it is, after all around us, we must understand that water, as we need it, is scarce. The total amount of water on Earth, based on some numbers that I saw, comes to over 1 million trillion liters of water. And I have it written down here in front of me to refer to, and I can look at it and see it. But it's incomprehensible, because it's a 1 followed by 21 zeros. And to think that there's that much water on the Earth, it's almost inconceivable that there could be scarcity. But of all that water, only about 3% of it's fresh. And of that 3% that's fresh, 70% of it is currently tied up in our glaciers and ice caps. 30% is in groundwater, and less than 1% is in surface water. And the rest is in the atmosphere and other ancillary places. our ability to access, store, treat, and use water then is an issue, and one that we need to consider when we're designing. If we don't have ready access to water, then what can we do to harvest it when it is available? Thankfully, the studies of those who have gone before us give us a number of techniques. We have swales, which are one of the most often discussed techniques, I think, in permaculture, to slow down the flow of water through a landscape and allow it to infiltrate into the ground. And if you're not familiar with them or you haven't run across them, a swale is a broad, shallow depression that's dug along a contour. And it may only be a couple of feet long or go for hundreds, thousands of feet. You may also hear them referred to as a dip in a hill, as often the soil that's dug out to make the depression will be piled up on the downslope side to create a broader, deeper swale that can capture more water. Once it's dug in, you can then plant along the top to help hold the flat or the ridge in place with trees and shrubs and other water-loving plants to hold that all together and take advantage of the additional water. And I've also seen examples that were built like dry creek beds, where the bottom of the swale is lined with rocks rather than plants. However you build it, the bottom should be permeable to allow water to seep into the soil. Doing a search for swale construction guide will yield a number of good results, and I've included links for more information on swales, including pictures and all, in the show notes. We can also capture water from a roof, and it's as simple as it sounds. The water that runs off of a roof during a rainstorm, be it a house, municipal building, or shed, any water can be directed somewhere that it can be useful rather than just letting it flow out of the gutters and to run away. Roof catchment can also be important in cities where the sewer and storm systems are sometimes combined, causing discharge and overflow issues during heavy storms. If we were to capture some of that water, it won't flow into the drains and can help mitigate this issue. And I bring this up because it's been brought to my attention as a problem in the city of Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And I like the idea of catching some of this water all over the city to help alleviate the problem. And I also see gutter systems on some older buildings. There's a church that I was doing some work at that was built in the 1950s, and the gutters from that go directly into the ground. And in talking with the minister there, he said that they flow straight out into the sewer system, and there's all that water there that we can capture and use. One thing to note here, though, is that depending on where you live, there are some issues about water rights associated with harvesting water from roofs in some areas. So please check your local laws before you start trying to capture this water, especially if you're doing it into some kind of a tank or other obvious way. But just as we can catch the water running off of a roof, we also have the water that runs off of roads. If you've ever seen it flowing into a ditch or a storm drain, then you understand that water is available here for us to capture. If it flows into a grassy area, that ditch, if that movement can be slowed down, then more will have time to get into the soil. If it's from a city street, then maybe we can direct it into a greenway or lawn or other area where it can be saved from being flushed away and picked up by plants. And in that process, also think about ways that that water can be treated with living systems so that what isn't captured is in better shape when it reaches its final destination. And though we have surface water that we can capture, there's, of course, wells that allow us to reach down below the surface of the earth and tap into the local water table or aquifers. And they can be deep or shallow, dug by hand, using a well point that's hammered into the ground until it reaches water, at which point a pump can be installed, or they can be drilled. And the depths that each of these can reach vary, but some wells reach thousands of feet into the ground in search of water. But however they're created, wells are a risk of pollution and salinity, and in areas where the water is being pumped faster than the refresh rate, they can run dry and be unusable, possibly only after a season or two, but potentially much, much longer if depleted too much. So consider that inflow and outflow when you're looking to a well as a source of water and a way to protect it from contaminants. Another groundwater source to look for are springs, dry areas where water flows up from the ground to the surface. And they may be seasonal, only flowing when there's rain and snow melts, or it could be a permanent fixture in the landscape. And water flow can be very little, just a couple of ounces a minute or over 40,000 gallons in a minute. Now, those larger volumes you're likely to know about without doing much hunting, but you'll have to look more for those smaller ones unless a property owner already knows of its existence. And you can look up information on how to go spring hunting if you're interested. Another way to slow water and divert it so that we can harvest it is through spreader banks. And rather than pushing water down into a depression or guiding it into one, these aim to move the water around banks to slow its travel, and in doing so give it time to get into the ground. I found a link that's in the show notes that's an excellent document from Australia about how these function and how to consider putting them in place. Another way to help capture rainwater and get it into the ground is through tide ridging. And the information that I found on this comes from sub-Saharan Africa, and the technique involves digging small furrows that are separated by little dams, with plants placed on the flat or ridge next to them. As it rains, water fills the furrow, but the flow is limited by the dams, keeping it in place so that it can get into the ground and be useful for what's growing there. It's an interesting design that, as a result, from what I can tell, doesn't require the furrows to be on contour, but can be in whatever direction the farmer needs. There are also net and pan techniques. In this case, the net refers to channels or ditches that are dug to collect and direct water to a depression catchment area, the pan. One of the influencers of permaculture, P.A. Yeomans and his key line design, also give us key lines as a way to harvest water. As I understand it, first to identify the key point, which is the area where the land contour shifts from concave to convex, and then the key line is mapped as the contour that flows through that point. By then plowing with a yeoman's plow along this contour and continuing along the slope from it, water flow can be guided in such a way that reduces erosion and increases soil fertility and gets the water where it needs to go, into the ground. For more information on key line design, check out Yeoman's book, Water for Every Farm. It covers all his principles and does a much better job than I can give it justice. If you've been by the website in the last couple of months, I posted an article about a technique known as Zai that I ran across purely by chance while looking at the issue of desertification in Africa. And this is a technique for harvesting water that involves digging a hole that's 8 to 12 inches across and 4 to 6 inches deep for something like maize or wheat, and then they of course get larger for larger plants. And the bottom of the hole is where you put your seeds or your transplant, so that then when it rains, this hole captures the rainwater. And when combined with other methods to slow water flow, more can be captured and diverted into the hole. I like it because it's such a simple, elegant, beautiful technique, and I'd like to see it applied elsewhere in the world, where deserts and arid landscapes are an issue. We also have drainage aprons, which is an area of land that's generally clear of vegetation and other material, is smooth, and contoured towards a location. When it rains, the water then collects and flows down to the desired area. And I've heard of this used in dryland applications, especially in the American Southwest. Lastly, a catch-all for many of the techniques that I mentioned here, simply micro-catchment. And I think that Zai and tide ridging fall into this category. And these are techniques that are rolled into a simple design principle where you use berms and basins to collect water for planting. The form they take is numerous, but they use the same underlying idea of directing water runoff into a depression where it can be used. How large they are, the manner in which they are contoured, are all determined by on-site observation and need. This is a perfect place to apply the permaculture principles to a technique. I've linked to a nice PDF from the San Diego State University on these as a general practice. And now that I've covered all these ways to get water into the ground or into tanks or other places where we can store and use it, one last thing that we can consider to harvest water are plants, as they take it up into their roots and store it in their tissue. They're one of our biological resources for harvesting and storing this energy that comes through our system. Depending on what you use, they can collect water near the surface as it rains or pull it up from deep underground, in some cases increasing the soil moisture for other plants around them to use. And it's yet another yield we get through careful consideration of the plants to include in our system. And that little whirlwind trip ends the first part of water with harvesting. Now that I've covered different means for how to collect it, here are some methods to store it once you've done so. We can store water, like most methods in permaculture, in a myriad of ways. The cheapest and easiest place to start is just to get the water into the ground. Good, fertile, healthy soil can store a lot of water compared to what we can do with some of the other methods. So do what you can to slow it down. Keep the surface broken so that it's not compacted or crusted over, so that when it does rain or you have a flood that washes water over the landscape, you can use it. And as that water gets into the ground, you can also use your plants, not only to harvest it, but also to store it for you. And this can then be combined with conservation techniques such as mulches and ground covers to help keep that water in the ground and available to your plants. Otherwise, you're going to need to buy or construct some way to store the water. However small it may be, it's still an outlay of resources to do so. Ponds are one option if you have the open space to build one, but how to build them is beyond this episode. But if you've ever seen a farm with an obviously artificial pond, then you have an idea of what I mean. Or, you know, gone by someone's garden, they have a water feature. They can be many sizes and for many different functions, and there are people who specialize just in building ponds. So check them out. And depending on your situation, something else that you might consider is repurposing a swimming pool as a pond or for water storage. Beyond that, then, we also have containers, which are available in many sizes and capacities and ranges. I think of them in two general categories, really, small or large. Small is limited to what a couple of people can carry or move with a passenger vehicle like a pickup truck. They include plastic jugs, canteens, water bottles, pots, urns, or rain barrels. Large containers aren't things that can be moved, or if we wanted to, would require specialty equipment to do so, especially when full. In-ground tanks and cisterns come to mind, but also the water tanks that can be pulled by a tractor trailer, or maybe a very large rainwater system. Something else that I saw are specialty bladders used by the military to hold vast quantities of water. There's a local military surplus dealer, Coleman's, that one time I looked and they had bladders that'll hold thousands of gallons. But these large systems, whatever form they take, can be built from concrete, stone, plastic, steel, and can contain hundreds to tens of thousands of gallons or more. A general rule for these is that the larger the storage, the cheaper it's going to be on a per-gallon basis. But when you're thinking about a system like this and you go to price it out, in addition to the materials that you have to bring in, also consider any excavation, shipping, building, or licensing fees that may go with it. I was recently pricing some large above-ground tanks, which, on the outgo, were fairly reasonable, all things considered, at about 50 cents a gallon. But then I called for a shipping quote. That added another 50% to the cost. But generally, for these kinds of systems, as you start putting them together, a rough place to start, expect to pay around a dollar per gallon for some kind of large containment. But if you want to go even bigger for water storage, then you may want to consider a dam, which you can use to provide a water supply, generate power, divert a flow, or possibly, if you want to use a dam as a dike, to reclaim land. The types, construction materials, and methods for building a dam are legion. If you're considering one, you'll want to research or talk to an engineer on this one. My knowledge on them is only cursory at best. I can go out and I can read all kinds of information on them, but I don't feel comfortable presenting a lot because of the effect that they can have on the landscape. And having never had to work with them as of yet, my own inquiry into them for this show revealed just how much information is out there. Call around, find an engineer who works with something like this, and you can get more detailed information. And I'm sure if you go looking, you'll find books on dam construction. Okay, so you've got your water harvested. You figured out a way that you're going to store it. It'd be nice if it were pure, pristine, and clean, H2s and O's, but regretfully, that's probably not the case. So you're going to need some way to treat it. What can we do about that? One way that I found is flow forms. And at the moment, I'm kind of having a hard time coming up with a proper way to describe them. Suffice to say, they're specially designed containers that churn and turn water as it enters and flows through them. From looking at some installations of them, they're usually used in series and possibly with multiple parallel installations on a site, so that as the water is moved around in each container, it then flows out into another one where the process is repeated, oxygenating the water and creating an environment that is more supportive of aerobic activity and harmful to anaerobic ones. The sources that I saw use these as part of constructed wetlands and in gray and black water processing installations. Commercially purchased and installed systems are expensive. The ones that I was looking at were hundreds of thousands and even millions of dollars. But I still mention them here because I think you can probably find a way to make them much less expensive if you have a local artisan to work with, especially if you're not trying to do anything really hardcore with them, but instead are using them just for gray water or constructed wetland use. We can also process our water back through the landscape. Some things to look at are, again, constructed wetlands or a purposeful forest. There are many different methods for building your own wetlands, which I could spend many shows discussing, including but not limited to using bathtubs, plastic barrels, or digging one in to your landscape. The size and number of catchment areas you're going to need for something like this are based on the amount of flow you're expecting into and through the system. And the time to cycle water through the system may be just a few weeks or a year or more. This is one, again, that I recommend reading more on if you're interested in doing a constructed wetland. And of course, I've included links in the show notes. I also mentioned that purposeful forest because of the importance to me of performing riparian repair wherever possible. And the riparian area is the intersection or edge of where land meets a river or stream. Whenever you can, consider how you might be able to buffer this area and limit damage to it. This buffering protects the stream bank and with it erosion and helps to keep contaminants out of the water where it can flow away and into other areas. Where I live, allowing for designing a constructed forest band along a stream is a really appropriate solution for helping to handle water runoff. And there are articles in local newspapers about doing this kind of work on our farms to help reduce the nitrogen load coming off and draining into the Chesapeake Bay through the Susquehanna watershed here in Pennsylvania. And the current recommendations that I keep running across are to try to build an area that's 50 feet wide at a minimum, much more if possible. In addition to those general treatments, we can also look more closely at individual plant and animal species and combinations that can be used in or near water to remove contaminants and or increase oxygenation. These might include macrophyte plants such as bulrushes and cattails, or a bivalve like mussels. The amount of information on this topic, if you search through the literature and other media, is enough for a brain overload. But the idea is that if you know what your contaminants are, you can place the right animals and plants in a constructed wetland so that they can process your specific needs. But what those combinations are, you want to research so that you can get it right. But one example that I found is that if you're having issues with salinity, willow and reeds are two options. And in the case of these two specifically, they appear to be useful for both soil salinity and helping to reduce dissolved salts in soil, but also water salinity, though to what degree and how much is going to require more research. And if you're dealing with water that is cloudy, dirty, contains a lot of sediment that you need to process more quickly than just filling a bucket and letting it settle out, you may want to look at building a silt trap. These allow water to flow through while catching suspended particles. And if water is especially dirty, you may want to do this anyway as kind of a pre-filter before passing it into one of the other methods. And those are some general ways that you can process water. But should you need to drink it, once the worst of the materials have been removed through your silt trap or some other kind of filter, there are other ways that you can treat it, which include heat, ultraviolet light, or a sand filter. Heat can be used to either boil the water, killing any pathogens in it, or if you want to take it one step further, you can distill it, hopefully leaving any contaminants behind. And you can find plans for stills, both complex and simple, powered by your favorite fuel or the sun, online or at your library. Go chat with your reference librarian and see what they can drum up for you. They're fonts of a great deal of knowledge, and a lot of times when you get them rolling, they'll probably give you ideas that you never would have thought of. Now, if you're in an area where heat isn't the best way to process your water because of limited fuel, you may want to consider using ultraviolet light. You can buy commercial systems that use very strong UV to kill all kinds of nasties. I speak from personal experience here, as I have one of these systems in my current home and grew up with one. I don't remember why we had it when I was little, but where I am now, there's a concern over biological contaminants in the water. My well is a shallow one, and there's some infiltration from the local stream, which happens to run many, many miles away from me and is contaminated by deer and a wide range of other animals. So there's a lot of potential to wash these lovely, horrible little things into my water source, so there needs to be something to kill them. And part of my routine is to make sure that the system is still working, and if not, to stop my family from drinking the water. If it's out and the repair guys are unavailable, my water supply is no longer potable. But thankfully, we have a great source of UV available to us every time the sun's in the sky. Because as well as providing heat, the sun bathes us with ultraviolet light all day long. And if you have access to some clear glass bottles, you can make use of that great big beautiful ball of incandescent gas to take care of your water for you. Simply enough, you fill your container full of water once it's already been processed and filtered so it's fairly clear, cap it, and then let it sit in the sun for a while. How long depends on how clear the water is and how strong the sunlight is. If it's something like an old skinny Coke bottle or beer bottle, if you find them clear versions, then it might only take 2 or 3 hours, whereas something larger, like maybe a gallon glass container, might take all day. Again, know your water. And if you have any concerns, go longer if necessary. And the last method for making water more or less potable is a sand filter. And these are systems that use a column of sand on the top of which develops a biofilm of aquatic life that actively filters the water. And the sand then keeps that life supported on top while the water flows down and through the remaining sand and out for use. They're simple, cheap, and easy to build, and very useful for treating surface water. You can find a number of DIY solutions for building your own if you're interested, and this is a project that I would recommend anyone checks out and tries because of how greatly they can reduce bacteria and other contaminants in water. And they're a very appropriate thing that, as permaculturists, if we're called on to give aid somewhere in the world, it's a nice little idea to have in your bag of tricks. And sand filters are still used in municipal water systems, though this slow system has since been replaced by a fast system, which is able to filter more water, but it doesn't quite do the same job. By no means exhaustive, those are some of the ways that you can look at treating water. Whatever method you use, please consider what the possible contaminants are before proceeding. Again, not all the methods of treating water are appropriate depending on the situation. And that's where your skill and experience as a designer is going to come in. And as I said at the beginning, if in doubt, ask around and find someone who can help. There are a lot of people out there working on this issue. And then once we've found a way to harvest, store, and treat our water, we come to the last, which is using it. And when we use our water, we also need to consider what we'll do to conserve it wherever possible, reducing the strain that we put on the system as a whole, and making it available for others. So then, what can we do with our water while also reducing how much we use? We can recycle it by moving it through different parts of the system. Think of things like clear gray and black water cycling. The water used to wash our clothes or bodies can go out to a constructed wetland or used to flush a toilet. If you have an aquaculture system, you can take that a step further and build it into an aquaponics system so that the fish waste is being used to grow our plants. We can use the microclimates created by the way in which we store our water to influence our system. Having a water feature in a greenhouse can increase the humidity, reduce temperature variation, and if you have it stored in large tanks, act as a thermal mass that can extend the growing season in both directions, or allow us to grow plants from a warmer region than where we live. We can do the same thing with outside ponds by surrounding them with trees, so that as the water warms in the spring, so too will the trees, producing an earlier crop and also helping prevent damage from a sudden cold snap. Taking that into our Zone 0 and Zone 1 areas, our home and garden, we can save a lot of water. For your home, look for low-flow fittings for your sinks and showers when you need to replace them, as well as water-conserving appliances. Washing dishes in the sink and only using your clothes washer when it's full help. Rewear clothing. You don't need to wash it just because you put it on or wore it for a day running around the house. Unless you sweat a whole lot or you're really involved with something, it can take a couple of wearings before things get funky. Or if you want to take this further, catch the water that runs while you're waiting for your shower to get to temperature, and then water your plants with it. Flush your toilet less, like only when it really needs it, or maybe look at using a composting toilet. They're not as bad as you might think, depending on how you do it, though, again, local laws probably apply about what you can use and how you can use the resulting material. You can find more information on compost and your personal waste by checking out Joe Jenkins' excellent book, The Humidor Handbook. But then, from our home into our garden, consider how and when you're going to water. Whether it's early in the morning, evening, or late at night, they're all good. Middle of the day, when it's hot, sun's out, not so much. We can use sprinklers, which are easy and effective, but they can scatter water onto paths and other areas where we might not put it to direct use. For many of our smaller installations, consider looking at soaker hoses, drip lines, or going out and personally watering your plants. Use that as observation time to see what's happening in your garden and landscape. And as you do, place the water as close to the ground as you can. If you're using soaker hoses and drip lines, consider burying them underneath mulch so it sits next to the ground, water can infiltrate, and you're protecting it from evaporation. Which I should say is one reason to make sure you're using mulch. It conserves a lot of water, and also allows more of it to make it to the soil surface by keeping ground from crusting up or becoming compacted. You can use shredded newspapers, grass clippings, wood chips, or many other materials to serve as a quality mulch. And I've got an episode dedicated to mulch in progress, so I'll cover exactly what kinds of mulches you can use, how to mulch and all that, in more detail then. Another way to use water, if we're fortunate enough to have a source that's flowing near the site with a big enough head, which is the distance that the water falls from where it's collected, where it would go to a turbine, there's a potential for microhydro without a large diversion of water. Or if that's not appropriate, we also might consider the old-fashioned water wheel if we want to go in that direction. Water is also important to our needs to handle a fire. Though the risks for a fire vary widely, the potential is there. And if you identify a fire vector while you're working with a client, look to the water resources and how they can be used to mitigate this. And to round out our use of water, we come to the last of the many, many uses we can put it to, but of the ones that I want to touch on. And that's transportation. As I said in the very beginning, we've used water crafts of many kinds throughout our history. We've plied the water since time immemorial, be it on the ocean waves, the byways of streams and rivers, or across a placid lake. Even now we have great ships that can carry massive amounts of cargo all over the world to satisfy the just-in-time societies. And should we reach a point where we're not able to find a way to provide inexpensive personal transportation energy, then our intercoastal waterways may again become our interstate highways. And that rounds out this PDC episode on water. There's a lot there, so if you have any questions, please feel free to email me, show@thepermaculturepodcast.com, or head over to thepermaculturepodcast.com and leave a comment about the show if you want to expand on any of these topics. I'm working on the next PDC show, and we'll have that out in probably another 7 to 10 days. Until then, take care of the earth, yourself, and each other.